Hi, I'm Adam McKay, and welcome to Bedtime Stories with Adam McKay, the show where we improvise a bedtime story to hopefully help you ease into a wonderful night of sleep during these crazy, bonkers times that we're living through. Hello, Harry. How are you?
Hi, Adam. I'm good.
So we're going to do a bedtime story for our listeners. And I was just saying to you, I've had a little bit of a hard time going to sleep of late, given the events.
Yeah, and you can be vague because whenever this comes out, there will be new events. So.
Good Lord. I've always done a pretty good job of like keeping a sense of humor about this insane country that we live in and the insane big events going on in the world. But I'm going to be honest, the last couple of weeks got me. Yeah. I got a little dire. And I don't know if it's like this for you, but what happens to me when I get kind of on tilt is like we all have kind of that balance in our head of the kind of internal monologue of worry and busyness, which I think we're lucky that we get to do what we get to do because I can channel that into a script. Yeah. I can channel it into producing and giving notes or collaborating with different artists. Like, so we have cool jobs in that a lot of times that kind of ceaseless monologue that we all have in our heads, and hopefully it's not too negative and, you know, we all kind of learn to deal with it and have a balance. But yeah, the last couple of weeks, it got a little louder and a little more freaked out. And had a couple nights where I struggled going to sleep.
I've been catching myself doing this thing where I constantly am listening to a podcast or watching my phone just like to pay attention to something and kind of get out of my own head. But then I'll catch myself like up too late, just like dreading the little piece of time between getting off of my phone and falling asleep. And that is a sad realization.
So exact same thing. So I've been listening to podcasts and books on tape for the last 2 years. I kind of got in this habit, and you got to be a little careful with that because, hey, I like a good true crime podcast. I'm a human being who's walking planet Earth. They're irresistible. But if you don't set end when the episode ends, four of them will play a role and you will have effed up dreams.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why we do this podcast. Something you can put on. I'm making up the story, the bedtime story. It's a little rambly. There's parts of it that are flabby and lame. There's parts of it that get a little more interesting where I actually am surprised, but it's a voice in the background. And I recommend if you're listening to this podcast at bedtime, put on end episode when it's over.
Set a sleep timer.
So it doesn't play right into some sort of news show talking about the totalitarian upheaval of Hong Kong, which I'm sorry I even said that because you're in bed, you're relaxing, and we're going to tell you a bedtime story. So, Harry, you want to give me a word, an image, a thought, a sound, anything?
Sure. I'm going to go with polka dots.
Oh, who doesn't like polka dots, right?
They're great.
I don't think I have one piece of clothing.
I was just thinking that.
Not one. I have stripes, I have checks, I have patterns. You really got to be a certain kind of personality to pull off polka dots.
Yeah.
And I'm also not going to lie, I'm a little jealous of that personality. I don't know what I would be if I could pull off polka dots, but I would be willing to try.
It's hard for me to imagine. Someday you and I should plan. We'll come into the office and we'll both be wearing polka dot shirts and we'll just see.
Can we for real do that? But but honestly, I don't think I have any polka dot clothing. One thing I have is a polka dot scarf that someone gave me as a birthday present and I've never once worn it. And it's beautiful, by the way.
Yeah.
But if you let me know, I'll wear the polka dot scarf.
Cool.
We got to sync that up. Alan Montgomery took a great deal of pleasure in getting dressed every morning. It wasn't so much vanity that drove his meticulous, detailed choices in picking his wardrobe, combing his hair, brushing and flossing his teeth, going through his shoes. By the way, Alan wasn't even a clothes horse. He didn't even have a packed closet of hundreds of shoes, and he had a very small selection, about 8 different pairs of shoes, maybe about 12 pairs of pants, 15 shirts. I mean, he had a lot of clothes, but not a crazy amount. But the ritual for him in the morning was calming. It was closer to a prayer service or a Tai Chi kata, something that every morning was just for him, that he would take 30 minutes, sometimes 40. If he really lost himself, there were even a couple of mornings where he was a minute or two late for his job because he had taken an hour to pick out all his clothes and combine the colors and patterns and to brush his hair and to clean his teeth. And for him, and he wasn't even really aware of this, it was more of a feeling that kept bringing him back to the process of taking his time, getting dressed and ready in the morning. But for him, in a way, it was a celebration of himself. We tend to always say the word vanity, but this wasn't vanity. It was more of an exercise in self-care and appreciation. And a lot of time looking in the mirror. And he needed this. Without it, he would always go into the day with his sails dragging a little bit, not quite as much push, not quite as excited to be in the world and alive and engaging. And once again, he never even really consciously thought of this. It's just something that developed. And he loved clothes with certain feelings to the fabric. Thick corduroy was one of his favorites. Alan lives in Philadelphia, so the weather would occasionally be amenable to wearing really thick corduroy pants. He loved, I had a couple of linen shirts, but they were tricky because you'd wear them and they'd get wrinkled within a couple of hours. But sometimes he would even go with those, and loved some jackets that he had too, that he had had for maybe a year or two too long, where the thread and the fabric starts to come a little undone, which almost in a way made it more comfortable. And most of the patterns and colors that he chose tended to be earthy browns and reds and greens. It wasn't a flamboyant dresser at all. And his job in Philadelphia off of Market Street, he worked at the last remaining free daily newspaper in the city of Philadelphia, the Philly Town Crier. Back in the 60s and 70s, it used to be a pretty big newspaper, sort of the equivalent of the Village Voice in New York City. And it was definitely hanging on by a thread now. There were only 8 people that worked in the office, but Alan loved the freedom that it gave him. He was able to write pieces you couldn't write anywhere else and make wonderful mistakes and sometimes indulge in very small stories and other times go for quite large stories. Alan's claim to fame was that about 8 years ago, he had actually stumbled into a bit of a scandal in the mayor's office and had found that the chief of staff for the mayor was taking lots and lots of money from big companies and low interest loans and low interest mortgages in exchange for influence over the mayor. He had actually won a local award for that. Alan really enjoyed the people he worked with too. Everyone talks about the differences in the generations and how each generation has their own personality. But for Alan and the office at the Philly Town Crier, the younger people tended to share a lot of his values too. Alan's 61 years old. He's older, but very youthful. beautiful skin, long hair, shoulder length hair, salt and pepper. And the younger people he worked with, too, had clearly chosen to work at this paper for the same reasons that he had stayed at this paper. And he had been offered jobs through the years at bigger papers back when the Philadelphia Inquirer was still a print daily. He had been offered a job there, but he had turned it down. He'd been offered a job for the big paper in Dayton, Ohio, which would have been a significant raise. But instead, he kept his job, and he worked in this seven-office, one-floor setup off of Market Street. He had seen Market Street go from a very dingy, kind of filthy, rough street with a lot of empty storefronts to really flourishing in the years he'd been at the Philly Town Crier. So there was nothing unusual about this particular Tuesday morning when Alan woke up and opened his closet. It was a day like any other day. He was actually working on a piece about the influx of avocado into Philadelphia and how it had changed the culinary landscape of the city. And it had something to do with this trucking company. It had gone electric, so they were able to lower their rates of shipping and reach a little further out to farms. And because, anyway, a very elaborate piece about how the amount of avocado in Philadelphia had tripled or quadrupled, and that had led to some really interesting restaurants and a couple of chefs doing things they hadn't done. It was exactly the kind of piece Alan loved that he was able to write. But on this particular Tuesday morning, Alan went into his closet and started looking through his pants and shirts and going into his usual routine. And he bought a wonderfully colorful, still always deep-rooted colors, but burgundy, forest green socks that were just incredibly comfortable. He always looked forward to that part, putting the socks on. But he looked at his closet, and once again, Alan wasn't obsessive about his clothing, but he felt like he knew what he had. But this time he looked in and he saw a white-collared cotton shirt with polka dots on it. And at this point in the morning, usually Alan would go almost entirely unconscious. Everything was just a pure state of choosing the clothes and feeling the textures. There was almost no thoughts going on in Alan's head during this process. But when he saw the polka dot shirt, this white cotton shirt with light blue polka dots all over it, it did stop him. And unlike dozens and hundreds of mornings before, he went into thinking, where did that come from? And it wasn't front and center. It was sort of towards the back of the shirt. So it's very possible that someone had gave him the shirt as a gift, or he had bought it on a whim and it just had never worn it. And he stopped and he tried to think. And Alan looked at the shirt with the light blue polka dots on it. And they weren't aggressive polka dots. He could almost imagine himself buying this shirt. But at the same time, he had never worn polka dots in his entire life. He even remembered when he was in fourth grade for Halloween, he decided he was going to go as an old-fashioned clown. Even at a young age, and even way back in the 60s, Alan realized there was an irony to clowns, and it was sort of the early days of scary clowns or messed up clowns. And he even remembered when he chose the clown outfit, a lot of them had polka dots on it. He hadn't even chosen the polka dot clown outfit. He had gone with the one with big red puffy bodysuit or a jumper with white line stripes down it. So even when dressing as a clown, Alan had stayed away from polka dots. But wishing that he could just fade back into the morning routine of just choosing his clothes without thought, he abandoned the mystery of where this shirt had come from and instead reached out and took the shirt off the hanger and put it on and chose mustard yellow wide whale corduroy pants. And he picked a deep burgundy socks and he put on old wooden door brown loafers and his tartan wool jacket was over by the chair. He was going to wear that again. And he went and brushed his hair and his teeth. But the whole time, there was a little twitch, a little feeling of, I should take this shirt off. And Alan didn't do that. Alan would sometimes stand looking at the closet and his clothes for a good 5 minutes before he would choose the clothes, occasionally even 10 minutes, but he never went back and took it off. The whole part of the exercise was trusting whatever his body was telling him as far as what he would wear. But in this case, even when he had moved away from the closet, was at his bathroom sink, flossing his teeth, brushing his hair, there was almost a twitch in his left shoulder telling him, take this shirt off. But he didn't. He had never done it before, and he wasn't going to do it this morning. And the momentum of his morning routine carried him past the bathroom sink and over to the chair by the front door of his apartment on Pine Street. Pine and 6th Street is where he lives. Had the apartment back when it wasn't worth much, and it kept it through all this time as the neighborhood had become gentrified. And he began his morning walk north to Market Street.
Do you ever wonder how celebrities order food? Like, is Sarah Paulson a Diet Coke or a regular Coke girlie?
Some peasant Coke? No.
Or how does Sofia Vergara order a pizza?
No tomatoes. I cannot eat tomatoes.
Are you killed mushrooms?
Not really.
Okay. If these are the details you need, and I know you do, I have the podcast for you. I'm Jesse Tyler Ferguson, and on my podcast, Dinner's on Me, I take some notable friends of mine out to dinners in Los Angeles and New York City. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
That thing was delicious.
For his walk, it must have been in his head. He was wearing a jacket, first off, over the shirt. But he felt like people were looking at him differently. He felt like he was just a little bit louder in the world. And it was almost like a kid in second grade in the school play who was just this, you know, spear carrier in the background, or was playing the sheep in some sort of barnyard story with only one line, and the kid had showed up for the Friday night play and the lead was sick, and this kid had to suddenly become the lead. There was nerves, titillation, an uncomfortable feeling, some fear and excitement that Alan was feeling as he walked over to Market Street. He even laughed at himself because this was so small. I mean, these polka dots on this shirt were not bold, multicolored polka dots. Like I said, they were faded blue. I mean, they were polka dots, don't get me wrong, but it was hardly like he was walking down the street with a mohawk. So he laughed at himself and finally took a left on Market Street and made his way towards the entrance that would take him up the stairs past the old crappy elevator, which he never took because it took so long to come down. Even the doors opening, it felt like it would take like 40 seconds. So he always took the stairs. And Alan was in decent shape for a guy in his early 60s, which, let's face it, nowadays is not really old, and you can be in excellent shape. And Alan had fully embraced that opportunity. When he walked into the office, he went into his, once again, his usual morning routines. I mean, everyone enjoys a morning routine. He said hi to all the people that he would pass. Derek from North Philly, Cicada, who had gone to Drexel University, really smart, great guy, about 24 years old, and made his way past Katrina's desk, who'd written for the paper for about 6 years, and went past his editor, gave him a wave, and made his way into his office and did what he always did, which took off his jacket and threw it on the little love seat in the corner. His office was tiny, and made his way to his desk where he was going to finish up his piece about the explosion of avocado in the city of brotherly love. And there was a tap at his door, and Katrina was there, who, once again, he knew quite well. She said, Oh, wait. I'm so sorry. I forgot his name. Is our main character's name Tim?
Oh, isn't that Alan?
It's Alan. It's Alan. You don't have to edit that out, actually. You can leave that in.
Okay.
I'm making this up, so I'm going to forget names sometimes. Also, I'm 54, and definitely my memory is slipping. So Katrina knocked at the door, gave a little tap, and looked at Alan and said, Alan, are you mad at me? No. Why would you say that, Katrina? He just walked past me sort of brusquely and a little quickly, and your hi, your hello seemed a little more shrill than normal. And I started to think about 2 weeks ago when we had a little disagreement about the piece I was writing about the ska revival going on in town. And I just wanted to say, if there's hard feelings about that, I don't want that to be something that lingers. Helen looked at her and said, honestly, I'm not remotely upset with you. Okay, Katrina said, but he could tell she didn't quite believe him. And he decided to move past it and jumped back into his day and was writing away. And there was a call, a voice from outside, Alan, can we see you? And he came out, and Derek was there with Katrina and another one of the assistants whose name he couldn't remember. And then his editor, Chris, they were sitting there, which is exactly what Alan said in his head as he walked up to the group to remind himself, because he, boy, did he hate those moments where he would get that wrong. And Chris said to Alan, I want to have this discussion in front of everyone because I don't want you to yell at me. What are you talking about, Chris? Alan said. I would never yell at you. And Chris said, well, I think we all know that's not true, but I've decided to move your avocado piece to the back of the newspaper to right before the personal ads. Yes, the Philly Town Crier still ran personal ads in the back. There's still a demand for them. Some of their older readers like to use them. Like I said, this was a paper that was more of a throwback to the Village Voice from the 70s and the 80s, and they had gotten a lot smaller, but they kept certain things with their format. Well, why would you do that? Alan said, you haven't even read the piece yet. I'm finishing it up. And the people around him almost seemed to step back, and he had to look closely at Katrina. It almost seemed like she had tears in her eyes. And she walked away very quickly, muttering something about, I can't be here for this. And his editor, Chris, looked like they were almost steeling themselves for the conversation. I'm moving the piece to the back of the magazine because it's what I've decided to do, because that's my job. Derek, the gentleman from North Philadelphia, kind of took a step forward and said, Chris, do you want me to ask Alan to step out of the office? Chris said, no, Derek, I can handle this. Alan, almost now, talking in a low whisper, guys, I don't understand what's happening right now. You are the editor. You can move my piece anywhere you want. I was just trying to point out that you haven't even read it yet, and maybe, possibly, it might surprise you. With that, he looked at Chris, and now Chris had tears in their eyes. And Derek fully stepped forward and shoved Alan. Hey, man, back the fuck up. Alan was confused. Everyone in the office went into defensive positions. He looked over and Katrina had reemerged and was holding a phone in her hand and says, should I call the police? I said, what are you talking about? I'm trying to speak in a low tone. And before he knew it, it had happened. He had been maced. He forgot about Rowena. Very small, under 5 feet tall, college student who was an intern who had her hair tied in about 7-8 different mini pigtails, had shot his face with mace. Alan writhed on the ground. he'd never been maced, goes without saying. Once when he was in college, he'd been a half a block away during a protest for the invasion of Panama, where some police had fired off tear gas and he thought he had smelled it. And maybe just to be part of the group, had sort of acted, never said it because it would have been a lie, but sort of acted like he was a part of the group that was tear gas, but he'd certainly never been maced. And as he rubbed his eyes, sniffling and dry heaving, he looked up and realized, sure enough, there are two Philadelphia police standing over him. And before he knew it, they were grabbing his arms and lifting him up. Alan went completely limp as he could feel the police officers becoming more and more aggressive.
Sir, please stop resisting arrest, sir.
And next thing he knew, he could feel a nightstick hitting his legs. And he kept trying to say, I'm not resisting arrest. I'm just holding my body limp. But in a flash, he could feel himself being dragged down the stairs, and he was in a squad car. As he was pulled into the squad car, he looked around, and there were 6-7 other different police cars with lights flashing all in the front of his building. He was thrown into a cell, and he heard something mumbled or something said in the distance by some officers about resisting arrest, assault on a police officer, felony assault of 3 other people. And at this point, Alan, who didn't have his jacket on, but was in the polka-dotted shirt, which now had some blood specks on it, he couldn't tell. I mean, it must have been his blood because Alan hadn't balled up his fists, hadn't moved his arms, his legs. Was in the cell for a couple of hours until finally there was a rap on the cell, the very tiny cell, and it was a public defender, and they brought Alan to a room, and he sat down with the public defender, but there were 2 police officers in the room the whole time, and the public defender said, I want them here for my own security and safety. And Alan responded to this statement as slow and as calm as he possibly could. It was almost cartoonishly exaggerated. Why do you need them here for your safety? And with that, the public defender stood up and left the room and said, I can't be in this room. And the 2 police officers were on him in an instant. And he had already had his feet cuffed together, but now his hands were cuffed. And he was thrown back in the cell. Well, after a night of sleeping in this cell where 2 or 3 other people were thrown into the cell with him, pretty tough looking guys, by the way. One guy from South Philly, really rough. A couple guys from West Philly looked pretty tough as well, covered up in tattoos. But none of them bothered Alan. They didn't go near him. They didn't even make eye contact with him. The next morning, finally, Alan was able to communicate to one of the guards that he had a credit card and he was taken before a judge, and bail was set at $250,000, which Alan could not get his head around, but you only had to pay 10% of it, which was still a preposterous amount of money. So Alan had to take his credit card, his debit card, and call a bail bondsman to get out. The next morning, as the sun was coming up, he walked from the police station, crossed Market with hardly any cars in the street, made his way back to his apartment, and he, one by one, unbuttoned the buttons on the polka-dotted shirt, went into the kitchen, opened the cabinet under the sink, and stuffed the polka-dotted shirt into the trash can, and then went and laid down on his bed and emitted a long exhale and went to sleep. The end.
pretty strong defense for us not doing our polka dot day here at the office, eh?
I gotta be honest, that whole story was passive aggressive way of telling you, Harry, the idea of you wearing polka dots scares the crap out of me.
All right. Well, note taken, and I appreciate it.
Good night, everyone. Have lovely, wonderful, warm, relaxing sleeps. And we'll see you again for the next episode.
Good night. Bedtime Stories with Adam McKay is a production of Hyperobject Industries and Sony Music Entertainment. It's executive produced by Adam McKay, Claire Slaughter, and me, Harry Nelson, with production assistance by Jordan Allen and Zaylee Mahone. Engineering, sound design, and original score by Isaac Lee. Thanks for listening, and one of these days, you're gonna sleep forever. That's what death is. Good night.